Okay, so welcome everyone. And so for this afternoon, we'll do some guided breath meditation. I think do we normally sit for 45 minutes? Is that right? How do we do it? And when do we start? Do we just start straight away? Whatever I wish. Really? Finally. The universe has realized how it needs to be. In accordance with my wishes. Okay, fine. Okay, so I'll talk about breath meditation for a few minutes and then we can do some guided meditation till 4. So I think you probably all know how to meditate already, is that right? Yeah? More or less? Ah, there's always one honest man. So this is the thing, actually. We know how to meditate. Actually, there's not much to learn. It's pretty simple. We know how to do it, but we don't actually do it, do we? We sit down and we think we're going to meditate. We try to meditate. And then 2 minutes later, we've completely forgotten that we're meditating. We're going off and doing something else. There was a great Scottish philosopher. I was going to say English philosopher, but that would have got me in trouble with the Scots. He was a Scottish philosopher, David Hume, who talked very eloquently about this, the idea of not self. He said, when you look into your mind, you can see that there's nothing there but an endless stream of processes that change all the time. It sounds very much like another teacher that I've heard of once. But anyway, that's what he said. And he said that you can find that in that stream of changing processes, there is nothing permanent that you can cling on to as yourself. And he then went on to say, but I can guarantee you that after reading with this, even if you agree with everything that I've said, 5 minutes later, you'll have completely forgotten and that you'll go on acting as if the world is just full of people and selves and permanence. And that's the difference between Hume's philosophy and the Buddha's philosophy. But the Buddha's wasn't just a philosophy. It's not just thinking about these things, but it's about how do we train our mind so that we don't forget, right? How do we develop our mind in such a way that we can not only kind of see the truth in a fleeting fashion? Right? Albert Einstein said that he understands the theory of relativity only in occasional moments of exceptional mental lucidity. Right? That's Albert Einstein. Understanding his own theory. I thought I understood it when I was a 15-year-old schoolboy. So how do we make those moments of mental lucidity not be just a moment? Right? How do we make it being a period of time, or even be the norm? Right? This is what we're doing when we're doing meditation. Yeah? And this is what distinguishes Buddhism from being just a philosophy. It's a training for your mind. So this word that we use in Buddhist meditation, we use this word called mindfulness. In Pali, we call it sati. And it's a funny thing that Buddhism in the modern age has come along and given to the world free of charge this teaching on mindfulness. But now if you want to learn about it, you have to go and pay lots of money to go to a course to learn mindfulness. maybe if you pay money for it, then you have to see you have an extra impetus to learn. You know, some people don't like to come here to the Buddhist Society to learn meditation because they think that it can't be like real meditation because you don't have to pay for it. So we learn sati. And sati, we call mindfulness. The original meaning of sati is memory. And sometimes this seems like it's a paradox because people think of memory as being dealing with the past, whereas meditation is about the present. But sati doesn't mean memory in the sense of thinking about things that happened in the past. If you think about what memory is, the root meaning of memory, the important thing about memory is that memory establishes a continuity in time. Right? It establishes a connection between now and then. Right? Memory isn't just something random that happens. It's not like reading in a history book about something that happened in the past. There's a connected something. It's happened to the same consciousness, in this same stream of consciousness. So when we think of mindfulness as memory, think of it in that same way as being like a continuity, right? A stream of consciousness with a continuity and a connectedness to it, rather than being fragmented and fractured. So normally our mind is darting around here and there, grabbing this and that. Getting all the things that it wants, and then when it gets them, that doesn't really satisfy it, so it goes out after something else. So with mindfulness, rather than being so fragmented and going around everywhere, we're still and centered. Okay? So this is why when we're practicing meditation, we use a meditation to calm and still the mind down. Lady's being very mindful opening the door quietly. There was a very mindful door opening. I hardly noticed it. So we bring awareness with some process. Maybe the breath, maybe loving kindness. It doesn't really matter too much. But it's something that's peaceful and something that brings ease into your heart. And something that gives you some continuity. So the mindfulness keeps the mind, keeps the breath in mind. So at every breath, we're remembering that this is what we're doing. We're remembering that here we are, in this meditation, here we are with this breath. And that's all we have to do. The less you do in your meditation, the better. And the perfect meditation is you're not doing anything at all. So this is why sometimes you can read books on meditation methods, and they can give you very complicated methods and do this and then do that and then this happens and that happens. It all sounds very impressive. And sometimes those things can be useful in some ways. But you might have noticed that in this temple, in this center, we're not so big on teaching complicated meditation methods. And this is one of the reasons why. So meditation is not about some kind of method that you can use. I'm going to do this and this and this and have that and that results. It's about being peaceful. It's about letting go. So the better your meditation is, the less method that you need. So when we're doing breath meditation, then some people ask, should I count the breath? Should I do a mantra? Should I watch the breath at the tip of my nose? Should I watch it at my belly? Should I do this or do that? And all of those things are fine, okay? If you want to do any of those things, that's fine. And if you do them and it helps your mind become peaceful, that's fine. But don't mistake any of those things for the essence of the practice. The essence of the practice is that we allow the breath to calm down your mind. That's all. Your breath is already calming you down. Even as you're sitting there right now, not necessarily doing anything, not even trying to watch the breath is already keeping you calm. If you don't believe me, try not breathing. After a couple of minutes, see how calm you are then. Right? What is it that stops us from panicking? What is it that reassures us that we're still alive? Right? That regulates our emotions. You know when you're feeling angry or annoyed because you can feel it in your breath. Your breath is constantly giving you feedback about how your mind is, and it's constantly soothing these things down. So we breathe, we keep that continuity of awareness with the breath, which is what mindfulness means. And we, as we watch, this magical process unfolds where the breath, that most ordinary and sort of basic kind of organic process, nothing to it, it transforms itself from something so mundane and so mundane that it's just boring. It's boring to be mindful of your breathing. But the longer we stay with it, and the more deep and the more clear our awareness becomes, the more amazing the breath is. And in this way, the breath is completely different from those things that we're going and seeking enjoyment from in the world. Anything that you have in the world, you want to enjoy an ice cream, the second bite or lick of ice cream is never quite as delicious as the first one. And by the third one or the fourth one, you've kind of forgotten that you're even eating it. That's how things go in the world. So we have to, if we watch the breath, we see that breath is exactly the opposite. The longer you're with it, the more you see it, the more clearly you see it, the more amazing it becomes. Okay, so let's do some breath meditation for the next 45 minutes. So I've got a couple of questions here. First one. Dear Yupa from Thailand. Hello, dear Yupa. How are you again this afternoon? And question. Why do some people meditate for years and never find peace, let alone seeing a nimitta? Meanwhile, some people, in brackets a friend of mine, who just start meditating can have a quiet mind quickly and have a nimitta, so just some nice blue lights nearly every time. Why is that? The world is unfair and unjust. Do you know anybody like that? Hasn't meditated very much, they just sit down and they have good meditation to start with? It's not uncommon, actually. Of course, the first kind of person is much more common, right? Meditate for a long, long time and don't feel like you're getting anywhere. But most of us fall somewhere in the middle, don't we? And most of us, we sort of practice and we can feel the mind getting a bit peaceful. And we can get some kind of sense of where the path is leading. And to me, that's the most important thing, right? Your mind might not be hugely peaceful. Maybe you don't have anything spectacular in nimittas or lights or jhanas or anything like that. But at least you get some idea of what peace means and where it can take you. So why is it that some people's minds peaceful? Well, the most obvious explanation is because of past lives, isn't it? I mean, so from the Buddhist point of view, if you've meditated in the past, then you've probably got some facility with it. And there's lots of cases with that, but not just with meditation, but with everything in life, isn't it? There's some people seem to have an uncanny natural ability to play a musical instrument at a very young age, or to pick up languages, or to do all kinds of things. And so that's just how it is. Abilities of humans are not distributed evenly. So there's nothing particularly unusual about that. But what is interesting, though, is that those kinds of gifts are not necessarily as much of an advantage as you might think. In the case of, because if something comes so easily to someone, then they often don't value it very much. I have some students of mine in Sydney whose son took up playing classical guitar and apparently was really brilliant at it and was, you know, so good that his teachers said they'd never seen anybody, you know, so good at it, and he could have become a professional concert classical guitarist. But after a few years, he just lost interest. And even though he could easily do things that it would take other people years to master, it didn't really mean anything to him. And so he kind of gave it up and, you know, not really followed it through. And I think we see the same thing in meditation sometimes. The people who meditation comes very easily for them, they can't really see what's the problem. They can't see why other people make such a big fuss about it. And they can't see what's valuable about it. Something that comes so easily, oh, well, whatever, I can get back there when I want to. You know, so why bother, you know, doing too much work or whatever? So don't think that because you're struggling or you're finding the meditation is slow, that that's necessarily a bad thing. The most important thing is simply that you're making progress, that you're keeping up a persistent effort, and that your mind is, you know, you can see some signs of peace developing in the mind. That's all. So don't worry too much about these things. The thing that, as a meditation teacher, that I look for in meditators, I don't. If somebody comes to me and says they've been meditating and I've seen these lights and I've seen these nimittas and I've had these jhanas, number one, I don't believe them. Sorry. Yeah. Because what do these things actually mean, right? Somebody can say I see a light, but what does that actually mean? My mind's very peaceful. What does that mean? until I know what somebody's like and until I can understand their meditation in detail and the process of their meditation in detail, really what they're telling me about their meditation is kind of meaningless. So I don't really care if somebody says these things to me. That's not important. But what is meaningful for me as a meditation teacher is if somebody is able to tell me clearly what's actually happening in their meditation, not by using technical words, right? Not by saying, I had this jhana or that jhana or this nimitta or this jhana factor or this, right? As soon as somebody starts using these kinds of language, I immediately think that they're covering up something. They're not actually telling me what's happening in their own words. They're just repeating something they read in a book or heard in a talk. And so they're distanced from their own experience. So I'm much more interested to hear, just very grounded and very down to earth, what is actually happening and what's the process of what's happening. If somebody can tell me not what states they achieved in meditation, but how their meditation unfolds, right? That's much more interesting, because a process is something that's more meaningful. Okay? You can see, oh, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. And then you can say, okay, well, that probably means something. Okay, so don't worry too much if people say they've got these things. If someone's enjoying their meditation, just say, great, you're enjoying your meditation, that's really good. That's all. And just encourage and support them. But for your own practice, don't worry too much about what states you're achieving. It's much more important to be concerned about understanding how your meditation works. Okay, next one. Could you kindly expand on the saying of the Buddha, my teachings are for those who feel? Thank you. So this is one of my favorite sayings from the suttas. The exact phrase is, Vediyamanasa bhikkhave idang dukkhang desemi idang ayang dukkha samudayo desemi ayang dukkha nirodho desemi ayang dukkha nirodhagamini patipada desemi. Something like that. So it is, monks, for one who feels that I declare this is the origin, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the ending of suffering, and this is the way of practice leading to the ending of suffering. And that's in a sutta, that's the sutta itself is the called the Anyatitya Sutta, which is Anguttara Nikaya 3.63, if I remember correctly, or is it 3.61? Something like that, anyway. Well, one of the really very interesting and very profound suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. So the idea here, for one who feels, right? So one who's experiencing suffering. For one who feels. Right? Very important, not for one who thinks, not for one who knows or who thinks that they know. Right? For one who feels. And when I kind of heard this, it was made an interesting connection in my mind. When I was a student here at UWA, I studied philosophy, and one of the philosophers who I read at the time was Peter Singer. And Peter Singer was, of course, the founder, more or less, of the modern animal liberation movement. And one of his principles in his philosophy, which really kind of stuck with me, was that when we're considering what rights animals have and how we should treat animals, questions are like, are they intelligent? Can they think? Do they have memory? Can they plan? And so on. None of those are relevant in the slightest. The only thing that actually matters is, can they feel? Right? If an animal is capable of feeling pain, then it deserves to be treated with respect, and we should have moral regard for that animal or for any creature. And so this is that same principle I recognized when I saw this in the Buddha's teachings. So the Dhamma is for one who feels. One of the implications of this is it's a universalist implication. Of course, it means all people, all human beings. And so it was a very broad, very inclusive thing. It's not limited by nationality or age or caste or gender or language or anything like that. It relates to a fundamental property of the human condition that we feel, that we suffer. We feel pleasures and pains. And so the teaching of the Dhamma addresses that. When we come to Buddhism, we shouldn't, in Buddhism, we shouldn't kind of shy away or hide from the question of suffering. Right? Suffering's okay. We all suffer. Now our question is, what do we do about it? Right? By suffering, we don't. When we talk about suffering, it doesn't mean we're not kind of worshipping suffering. Right? I once did this interfaith thing with this Anglican priest, and he said, "You know, one of the things about you Buddhists that I don't get is you just worship suffering so much." And I said, "But hang on, you know, our main image or icon is of a man sitting quietly and smiling, and yours is of a man stuck up on the wall, nailed to a cross, who's worshipping suffering." So even though that we acknowledge the suffering, it's a reality. But it doesn't mean we're not, there's nothing, it doesn't mean there's something good about it, it just means that we accept it. So we accept the suffering and we practice. And one of the things which is very, very distinctive in Buddhism is that the teaching, the practice of Buddhism is so deeply associated with pleasure. And this is something which is very, very counterintuitive. There seems to be something which is very hardwired in us psychologically. You see it very widely across different cultures, where we associate what is good for you is what hurts, right? Especially in the spiritual sphere, but just generally, right? If it hurts, it's good for you. And if you look at different spiritual practices all around the world, there's so many cases of sacrifices or tortures or torments or abstinences and fasting and all of these things, these painful, difficult practices that are associated with religion. And so this was one of the most radical and most powerful things that the Buddha came along to say, was that our practice, our spiritual practice, should be full of joy. It should be full of pleasure. It should be full of happiness. And he said, "Ma bhayitabhang, na bhayitabhang." It's not to be feared. Okay, so this pleasure that we experience through our meditation, through letting go, through peace of mind, na bhayitabhang, should not be feared. Doesn't lead to anything harmful, only leads to peace, to clarity, to eventually to enlightenment. So when saying that the path of Buddhism is for one who feels, the feeling initially is that the realization of suffering, and then the practice of suffering is the feeling of pleasure that we experience through the meditation and the other things that are part of our practice, and then ultimately the freedom from all of these forms of suffering. So I hope that clarifies that teaching a little bit. Okay, very good. So let's finish up this evening by paying respects to the Triple Gem. And just before we go, just to mention, some of you may have been here on last night for the talk, and Cecilia mentioned that there is a busy bee tomorrow at Dhammasara Monastery. So those of you who have done lots and lots of bad karma in your past and are terrified of where you're going to be reborn again, now you have an opportunity to go and make some good karma. So they'll be doing some like clearing fire breaks, raking and things like that. And as you know, it's a small community of nuns out there and a very, very big property. So there's no shortage of good karma for you to do. So if you'd like to go out there tomorrow from 8:30 till 4 for the busy bee at Dhammasara Monastery.